Today is April the 2nd, 2006. And what I'd like to do is to have Mr. Britton go over our week's agenda and whatever other niceties he has in store for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I'll refer you to the weekly agenda, week of April 2nd through April 6th. Today, as you know, we're going to continue with House Bill 5031, as we will during the rest of the week. Today we'll be discussing or continuing our discussion of the medical assistance programs. Tomorrow is significant because we have added a work session on a Department of Human Services federal grant application request. Education and Training Administration of the United States Department of Labor Long-Term Care Workforce Development Grant. And I have some materials to hand out to you in preparation for that work session tomorrow. On Thursday, we'll be continuing with House Bill 5031. At that point, the medical assistance programs will kind of wrap up their presentation. But I've also asked the Department of Human Services to walk you through the numbers related to the governor's recommended budget. And those numbers, at least for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs, are found toward the back of your binder under Addenda 1. And if you look at that for a second, you'll see the Division of Medical Assistance Programs and the building of the budget, the base budget, the essential packages, the policy packages, and so on. And on Thursday, as I said, I've asked the department to walk you through those as far as each of the three divisions within the health services program area, the Division of Medical Assistance Programs, Mental Health Division, and the Public Health Division. So we'll be working on that more on Thursday. Last point I wanted to make was that on Wednesday, April 4th, we have a day of public testimony scheduled for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. So if there are people that want to testify there, that's the day for them to do so. Turning to today's agenda, again, House Bill 5031 will be continuing the discussion of the Oregon Health Plan, Children's Health Insurance Program, and non-Oregon Health Plan payments. We covered a good bit last Thursday in your books, and right now we're ready to begin the measures, which starts on page 35 of the presentation notebook. With that, I'll turn it back to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Page 35.
Mr. Edgeman, you join us? And whoever else you'd like to come with you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Edge, for the record. I'm the interim administrator of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs and the Department of Human Services. Yes, we're ready to begin day two. We covered a lot of overview material last Thursday, covered services, clients and client groups. We're ready to begin a section on measures, and what we would like to be able to cover today, if time allows, is not only the section on measures, but also a section on quality and efficiency improvements, and cover pages 35 through 57 in your notebook. I have with me at the table this afternoon Mr. John Pilkey, who's the manager of our quality improvement and medical section, and Dr. Wallace Schaefer, who is our medical director, who will talk through the measures section. So with that, I'll turn it over to them.
Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you. Chair Senator Carter, members of the committee, I am John Pelkey, the Quality Improvement and Medical Section Manager for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services. And with me to my left is Dr. Walter Schaefer, Medical Director for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. I'm very pleased and honored to have the opportunity to present testimony and information to you today. We will be presenting, as mentioned, the key performance measures, which begin on page 35. And I'll take the lead on a general introduction to this section and also cover the first two performance measures. And then Dr. Schaefer will cover the balance of the performance measures. By way of introduction, and really to frame the discussion on performance measures, I would first offer these overall observations. In addition to the goals that you see at the top of the page on page 35 for the department, we are guided by our department values. We are a values-driven department, and therefore the values of integrity, stewardship, responsibility, respect, and professionalism, they guide our conduct always. Within the Division of Medical Assistance Programs, there is a renewed and even greater emphasis on clinical quality performance improvement and also upon customer service excellence. We have renamed our section to be the Quality Improvement and Medical Section, and among our duties is to work directly with the managed care organizations to monitor, provide oversight, and support for those local clinical quality performance improvement projects, including those directed to customer service excellence. So one point to keep in mind as we look at today's presentation, we're presenting a high-level key performance measures. We also work with the managed care organizations on those local quality performance improvement projects. This is an effort, I should say, that we are jointly committed to. The managed care contractors are required to have performance improvement projects conducted yearly, and I would add that we meet with them on a monthly basis to have a quality performance improvement work group meeting. This is all in the nature of moving toward a culture of quality. Excuse me. From a national perspective, there's also a move toward a values-driven healthcare system, toward measuring and sharing quality information, promoting quality and use of evidence-based best practices, which we know positively impact health outcomes. Unfortunately, what we see across the nation increasingly is data that reveals that patients do not consistently receive care that is appropriate, timely, or evidence-based, and that can lead to adverse outcomes. In the draft report from the Oregon Health Policy Commission, which was just released, they offered a roadmap for healthcare reform. And one of their recommendations is drive public and private stakeholders to continuously improve quality, safety, and efficiency to reduce cost and improve health outcomes. We believe that our reorganization within Division of Medical Assistance Programs does align us well and puts us in a good position to improve clinical quality performance and service in collaboration with our stakeholders and to respond to those national trends and directions as well as the Oregon needs and trends. So before we move to page 35, just to sum up, I would say that really one of our key objectives in the department and in the quality improvement and medical section, it's to build relationships and build collaboration with our stakeholders so as to facilitate continuous quality performance improvement of care and service. Within that entire effort, there is a substantial amount of transparency. There's a sharing of best practices. There's a mutual commitment and accountability with the contractors to continuously improve. In short, there's a mutual commitment for learning. And learning, we know, is the cornerstone of any good performance improvement process. If you would please turn to page 35. We'll note that the first performance measure, number 25, is the routine health care provided to Oregon Health Plan clients, broken out by child and adult. And key performance measure 26, which is the racial and ethnic variation of routine health care. One of the fundamental strategies within the Oregon Health Plan is to utilize managed care.
Madam Chair, before we go further, did you give us your comments in writing? Do you have printed material?
No, sir.
I would like printed material.
Yes, sir.
Because I want to hold you to everything you've said, and I want to see it in writing.
Senator Morissette, I will provide that in writing.
Thank you.
That tells you he was impressed.
Very good. Senator Carter, members of the committee, one of the fundamental strategies under the Oregon Health Plan is to utilize managed care. Under managed care, the incentive is to keep the patient healthy and well, to emphasize prevention, education, routine health care, so as to prevent serious illness and disease. And access to early and routine health care allows for that early detection, prevention of disease, and early education. So that's tremendously important as part of the managed care program. If you would please turn to page 36, you see the actual scores for the most recent score for the proportion of Oregon Health Plan clients who received health care services annually. The rates of routine health care to adults and children have increased in 2005 to 75.7% for adults and 72% for children. And if you look at between 2004 and 2005, we have an increase of 0.7% for adults and 1.4% for children. Certainly, this is good news that we're heading upward, but there's certainly more work to be done. If you look back in history, and the graph shows back to the year 2000, we saw the performance go down in the year 2001, and we believe that was largely impacted by the economy. In 2003, we also had another bump down as with the changes to the Oregon Health Plan standard in terms of moving some of those clients to fee-for-service, and we saw another drop in the measure as it was harder for some of those clients to get in for a visit. And now we're starting to see the performance on this rate gradually increase, so we are getting back to the levels that we were previously had previously attained. You'll note in the results narrative at the bottom of page 36 that the managed care organizations are required to provide a medical home. And a medical home is really a valuable concept. It's essentially having a regular physician or regular clinic to receive care. And we know that there's tremendous benefits to this. One main physician that knows you and knows your health problems, one main physician that knows your medications, knows the tests that you're taking, knows your medical history. One main physician that can provide the primary care, and then as needed, link the patient up to the specialty care.
So, question.
Senator Carter?
We heard that bill in another committee that I'm in, and are you guys taking a leadership role on setting up medical homes? If we can find the money in the legislature this session, you guys will be a part of that?
Madam Chair, we are supportive of that concept, yes, and I think it would be a joint effort between the division, the public health division, and our division if that bill were to pass, and we are certainly supportive of the concept of medical homes. There is a, if it's the bill I'm thinking of, there's an emphasis on medical homes in federally qualified health centers and safety net clinics, and so in large part that would be managed through the public health division, but we would do it cooperatively with them.
Okay, one other question. Do you have data showing savings as a result of having medical homes as opposed to not emergency rooms, but hospitals for maybe a one-day stay or something of that nature?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware that we have enough information yet to show that kind of data, the actual savings. But we're confident that it certainly improves quality, and we're confident that it will show savings, but I don't think we have that data yet.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Question for you on page 36. How are you defining routine health care? What codes are you tracking? I'm just wondering what your compilation of codes for the different age groups and how you, what's your definition?
Representative Cote, Madam Chair, that I could not give you the specific codes right now, but that they generally include the routine type visits, well child visits, physicals, visit to a physician for a routine primary care visit. That would be considered part of routine health care. That's my understanding of that.
Thank you. Follow up?
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's helpful. Thank you. In terms of tracking for how well we're handling OHP clients and their ability to manage their chronic diseases, whether it's asthma or diabetes, have you considered a performance measure to track particular types of conditions and how well we're managing them? Just wondering if that's been a discussion internally.
Representative Kotek, Madam Chair, I think that's an excellent question. And as the important thing is that we're measuring performance, I think the next question is, are we measuring the right, do we have the right measures? And I think we're entertaining right now within the department, are there other measures that we should be looking at that would get at better get at the outcomes that that we provide? So that that is something that we will look at in terms of looking at those measures.
Thank you, because it's my understanding there's been some diabetes isn't what I've been paying most attention to, whether or not clients are actually given the support to get through and actually management of their diabetes in a way that's actually cost effective, and I don't know if we can track that somehow, so thank you.
Do we have that, Ms. Fudge? Is there a strong education component of diabetes education in DMAP or?
Madam Chair, yes, we are moving in that direction, and actually I think as Dr. Schaefer gets into some of his discussion of specific diseases that we're looking at and some of the disease management and case management that we're doing, he will answer that
question. You didn't have to answer one of the benefactors in the back just shaking his hand like this, so I got that message early. Thank you very much. We'll wait until that time.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, additional narrative on the results on page 36 shows that there's a focus on performance and improvement projects, and it indicates some of the focus areas, which are tremendously important: tobacco cessation, asthma, diabetes, prenatal care, early childhood cavity prevention, and so on. It also notes some of the barriers to increasing the proportion of clients in this measure, and that includes physicians who do not accept Medicaid patients, which is at about 9% as of the most recent survey. One of the ongoing barriers for this measure is clients' lack of understanding about the importance and value of routine health care visits. And this is an issue which I should say that the managed care organizations actively work on along with the Department of Human Services. It's really in both the interest of the patient and the managed care organization to get the patient established early, and many of them actually have programs to do outreach and welcoming in of the new member to get them assigned to a primary care physician into a medical home. So that's tremendously valuable. At the top of page 37,
Madam Chair,
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. Before we go there, and you're probably going to tell me you have an answer for this as well, where does nutrition fit and obesity as well as it relates to education, prevention?
Madam Chair, Senator Gorley, nutrition is obviously it is a very important topic. That would be considered part, I believe, of the routine health services that are provided to the client. We know that from experience that nutrition, counseling, diet control, exercise, all those are very key aspects to encouraging a healthy lifestyle, to attaining better health outcomes. So nutrition is a very much an integral part of the services provided. And my assumption, I would need to look to Mr. Jim Edge, but my assumption is that nutrition is included as part of that routine health care.
I would like to know with certainty that it is. Not seeing it on the list raised a question for me, particularly given everything that we are learning and all of the focus that's been on obesity of late.
Mm-hmm.
Not to see those on the list just raises a flag for me.
Go ahead, Will.
Yes, Chair Carter, Senator Gordley, I'll just add some information of particular interest in answer to your question. The diagnosis of obesity has actually been below the funding line and in the past and current prioritized list of the Health Services Commission. In the current review, last year's review of the prioritized list, because of the epidemic of obesity and the associated health problems, the Health Services Commission decided to not only put obesity above into the funded portion of the list, but towards the top of the list, in one of the top 10 or 12 diagnoses, to emphasize the importance. So it is of interest that the Oregon Health Plan has not specifically covered obesity services, but now the intention is to do so. The problem, of course, is that we want to cover treatments and interventions that are known to be effective, and that is more difficult to determine for obesity treatment than it is for certain other conditions like appendicitis or whatever, where you know which treatment is effective. So the Health Services Commission is in the process of defining what medical and counseling interventions should be covered on the Oregon Health Plan, and also what surgical interventions for bariatric surgery, and that process is going on currently.
Senator Marshall?
I'd like to look at a current schedule of medical courses being taught to doctors, because nutrition hasn't been one of them for a number of years, and I'm wondering who the experts are in the field. I don't think your average family physician probably is an expert. So who are the experts that are going to be doing this? If you could give me some information, I'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, we will get back to you with that information.
Representative,
thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to follow along the lines of discussion of nutrition. Often when I ask a question about nutrition and receive a response, the information we receive is usually more related to what we do after the fact. Once someone comes to see a doctor and some of the problems are identified as diabetes or a consequence of obesity, then is their treatment and what can be done. I'm not hearing much information yet about what we are doing proactively in the area of nutrition, not after the fact, but what we can do to prevent children and adults from getting to the point where they have very serious and chronic health problems that may impact the rest of their lives. I really have still not heard much in the way of what we're doing in the way of prevention. And let me give you a little example. I was reading some information somewhere about information that is sent through the mail to Oregon Health Plan clients. I am fortunate to have health insurance, and I regularly receive communications, whether it's by email or something that comes in through the Postal Service, little newsletters, and often there's helpful information about, here's some ideas for healthy snacks that actually taste good and don't cost more than what you're spending now, or just as tasty but more nutritious. What do we do to help the people in Oregon learn and adopt some new patterns that will be in a way attractive to receive the information rather than continuing to pay after the fact once people are already suffering?
Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson, I would say that there is a very strong commitment to prevention, getting that message out. On page 37, to the right, we talk about some of the ways that we get that message out about prevention. It is definitely something that we share with the managed care organizations. All of the contractors are very strong in terms of promoting prevention. Just last week, Dr. Goldberg noted that today is actually Public Health Week. Apples were presented, of course, at the Capitol today as part of the Prevent, Promote, and Protect theme of Public Health Week. I would say that there is a very strong collaboration between all of the divisions within the Department of Human Services really to work on the prevention issue. So it's a point well taken, and I think all of us can always do more in the area of prevention.
Madam Chair, the thing that's interesting about that list on page 37 at the top, I was looking for the word nutrition to jump out, and it still doesn't. All of those conditions have some tie back to nutrition. But there's nothing here that tells us explicitly that as a strategy, preventive strategy, that there is an emphasis on prevention and what that emphasis and strategy look like. So we're left to try to peel that onion back to see where that piece is, and I'm still not clear that I understand.
Okay. Well, one of the things, colleagues, I think would be important for us, and that is 98% of this agency's budget is contracted out. Mm-hmm. So they don't have prevention programs within its body. It's just like was just stated, that what they do is work with the NHOs and other people that they work with to try to get them to focus on something. And if that is something that you'd like to pursue further, I have to try to think about how we get that, because I'm not so tied up with mandates and trying to get them to keep some of their money, because then you've got the business community out there that they contract with will come apart and do something of that nature. Maybe we could send something urging Mr. Edge and his department to work in working his relationship with the MHOs, MCOs, whomever else they're working with, that this would be one of the areas that the legislature is interested in, since obesity is a major problem. Since we all know how much money it's costing us in bariatric surgery as well as in other health care areas with the whole issue of obesity, and especially among our young people, the costs associated with that. So let me work with Mr. Edge to see what we can come up with in certain terms of getting the department to look at something where then they can feel as if we have given them the charge, and then they can go out and charge their partners. Because like I said, 98% of their budget goes out. And when you look at the whole human services budget of DHS, 85% of the dollars that goes through DHS is contracted out as well. So we'll see what we can work with Senator Cordley, Senator Nathanson, and Senator Morissette, with how we can give them a charge. Does that sound like something?
Madam Chair, you're exactly right that most of the services we provide are through contracts with managed care organizations, and that's where much of that information, educational information comes from. In fact, we would be happy to set up a presentation by a managed care organization if you'd like to do so. I know that a couple of our managed care organizations are planning on testifying during public testimony day, and you can hear from them at that time, and we can ask them to specifically address that. And we do get the message, we're hearing the message, that you would like us to focus on that aspect of prevention, the nutrition aspect. I think the schools are another place where we want to be sure that that's happening too.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to say it's a really excellent point. I hope we'll see some of the managed care folks here for public testimony, ask them that. But we set the contracts. And so my question is, if you can get us in writing what their performance, there are some performance expectations for the MCOs around prevention, I would assume. And I would assume that if they don't reach them, then it's a problem. So I don't know if you could provide that information for us, what you're asking them to do specifically as part of their contract. And then we'll ask some questions when they come as well. So.
Yes, we'd be happy to do that, Representative Kotek and Madam Chair. Mr. Pelkey is the new manager of this section, and he is responsible for those activities around the contracting with the managed care organizations. So he's still in his learning curve, doing an excellent job, and is the one that we'll rely on for that sort of information.
That's good. John, can you just write up the kind of the question around the consensus of this to give to him, and then will that be a satisfactory direction to start, Senator Wardley and Representative Nathanson?
It is for me, Madam Chair, as long as we understand that DMAP does administer the programs and the contracts.
Right.
And picking up on Representative Kotek's point, you can write into the contract what it is you want to see the folks out there do.
Yeah, and so that's what I was saying, but we do have John to write the question in terms of the charge to them on that front.
Since we have capitated rates, and if we're talking prevention, are those rates prevention the same as if you're talking about other kind of care?
Madam Chair and Senator Winters, yes, we pay for capitation based on actuarial calculations of the cost of providing services, and to the extent that we asked for a service to be provided in the contract, the capitation rates are calculated at the cost of those services, so yes.
I raise that, Madam Chair, because there was some discussion several years ago that the payments for the doctors for prevention was less than some of the other kinds of care. And so if we're going to shift towards to make certain that we are doing prevention, we also need to make certain that the rates are such that doctors won't abandon preventive medicine. So that's why I raised it, and I want to be sure that it is adequate capitation rates so that they will want to provide those services.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, you may be talking a little bit too about the fee-for-service side of our program, where the physicians haven't received any increases in a number of years. So,
but I would like to follow up, Madam Chair. I want to make certain that both, that we have both the managed care organizations as well as the fee-for-service. I would not like to see us asking or request that you begin to go down the pathway of preventive care and then to find that the rates aren't commensurate or adequate enough to provide those services. So just for my edification, I would, and I think for others on this panel, would like to make certain that we don't have a disparity in rates.
Well, I'm really kind of glad, Senator Winters, you said that. I was trying to be really precocious and say that 98% of their budget
went outside of other people and trying to stay away from the word mandate, because then you start, you're talking about increase in cost of reimbursement if that happens. And so we want to try to work with Mr. Edge in such a way that we're not mandating something, but at the same time encouraging it contractually, so that, that the legislature can have some of the wishes granted that you'd like to have. Because I'm telling you, if all of our doctors start coming in committee and talking about how you put another mandate on us and you're not even reimbursing us at a level, especially hospitals at 72% of doctors at what percentage that we reimburse.
I don't know. Okay. Doctors? Madam Chair, what was the question?
We reimburse doctors at what percentage rate? 74%. You got the
Madam Chair, in the fee-for-service side of the program, the reimbursement rates are very low. And it's actually part of the governor's recommended budget to use a portion of the new tobacco tax to bring those rates up to about 75% of the Medicare rates and give the physicians an increase.
Yeah. But I just want to make sure that the committee understands that when we start talking about doing something outside of what we're doing right now, what we're asking for in terms of those kind of issues as well.
Madam, can I make a comment or an observation? We were just going through talking to ourselves, and as those who know me know that I really react to the alphabet soup because we tend to talk to ourselves, and Senator Glenn and I are sitting up here saying, what does PCM mean? What does this mean? I would ask that you either have a legend or that when we go through it that you provide us with the actual name and terminology, since we don't have Rosie the Pig up here to find you like we did a couple sessions ago. But that would really help us a lot.
I hope it doesn't sound like I'm defending these guys too much, but they presented a glossary of terms. I think it was just... But anyway, look on page 29 of 86.
Primary care managers found it.
Yeah, thank you.
Madam Chair, and Senator Winters, and the PCM is primary care manager. And at this time, Madam Chair, members of the committee, just a few other comments on page 37. At the top of the page, we do talk about the disease management and case management program, which is a tremendously valuable program. We work with McKesson Health Systems and Innovative Care Management on that program. And right now, there's about 8,600 clients on that program each month, in addition to about 385 on the medical case management. And those are directed at, as you see, those issues of asthma, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, coronary artery disease, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. We did hear the discussion on nutrition. My belief is that nutrition is embedded into the services that they do provide to that population. In addition, there is a telephone advice nurse line that is available. They're serving over 7,200 clients a year with that telephone advice line. And that is available to all fee-for-service clients, not just those on disease management. But disease management has been a very valuable program. It's now estimated in the state of Oregon that over one-third of Oregonians report a chronic disease. So it is a significant problem. We were talking earlier about obesity. The statistics on that are that 23.8% of adults are obese. And if you count overweight and obese together, the figure becomes 59.7%. And that's out of the recent report from the Oregon Health Policy and Research. So the disease management program is a very valuable program. We've estimated that net savings is really in the range of $2 to $4 million since the program began in 2002, and it has served over 29,000 clients since that time. At the bottom of page 37, we note that there are really no comparative standards for this measure. But what is important is that we do conduct the measure, we do our own self-assessment, and that we're really transparent in reporting the results. And Oregon really continues to be a leader in this regard. If we could turn to page 38... On page 38, we show the racial and ethnic variation broken out by African Americans, Native Americans, Asian Pacific Islanders, Hispanics, and whites. And I have a supplemental report, if Mr. Britton could distribute that to members of the community, of the committee. The first comment I would make is that it's really important to shine a light on this topic. Very important and very valuable. Reducing disparities is a priority of the department, and a key step in that is measuring the disparity, sharing the data, and working with the managed care organizations and others to reduce that disparity and increase the level of cultural competence in delivering care and service. So again, we want to learn from the data, utilize that data as part of a performance improvement process. If you look on page 41 under the results section, it indicates that for all race and ethnic categories, the score has increased. There's a general favorable trend. However, the data also show that disparities do continue to exist. The data tells us that we all have more work to do in terms of reducing racial and ethnic disparities. And I wanted to draw your attention to a valuable project that the state of Oregon has participated, and you should have that in front of you. Working with the Center for Healthcare Strategies, the state of Oregon, together with a number of the managed care partners, developed this toolkit for reducing racial and ethnic disparities, a quality improvement initiative, and Medicaid-managed care. And as I say, Oregon was an active participant in this process, in this project, along with Care Oregon, Family Oregon, Providence Health Plans, and you'll see them listed on page 6 of this toolkit. This was really a wonderful and exciting collaborative effort aimed at creating some useful interventions which can reduce the disparities. And the Oregon project is actually outlined on page 42 of that document. There's also within the document an excellent summary on future directions. And these are excellent ideas for interventions that the managed care organizations can use in terms of reducing their disparities.
Madam Chair.
Senator Courtney.
Thank you. Looking at the key performance measure 26 on page 38 of our notebook, is responsibility for this measure shared with the Public Health Division?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, this is not a shared, technically it's not a shared measure, but I would submit to you that it's a measure that everyone has to be engaged in and supportive to attain the results. So it would be a measure that we would seek to reach out to other divisions, to other departments. I think the projects that have been successful have been the ones that show that collaboration, the public-private collaboration to make those changes.
So is it accurate to say that there is intentional collaboration between your department and public health in reaching the goal captured within the Key Performance Measure 26, shared responsibility for the measure. And as a part of the question, I'm also wondering what coordination there is between your office and the Office of Multicultural Health in the Health Division. Shared, again, collaboration,
Senator, Madam Chair, Senator Corley, yes, I would describe it as fully collaborative. There is a commitment to reduce racial and ethnic disparities, and this means we do collaborate across the department. And so I would say, I would answer yes to your question. It is a shared, it is a shared goal, a shared responsibility.
What are the issues around data collection, if I may follow up from your perspective?
The issues around data collection?
What are they from your perspective?
Senator Gordon, Madam Chair, I think it is, in terms of what I understand, we have changed the way this measure is calculated, which is discussed on in one of the pages, I think prior on page 37. If you look at the bottom of page 37, we now count a client who was on the program for 6 months within a 17-month period. And my understanding, having just joined the department, is that prior to that, we had a different measure for the denominator, which excluded a number of managed care clients. So it's my understanding by making that change that it increased the denominator and increase the number of clients that are counted, and thus it is giving all of us better data on which to base our interventions. So that's my understanding. I think that was a good move that is giving us better data upon which to make our interventions.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, I'm having some problems here. When you gather data, and I know you haven't reached back in terms of your predecessor, when you're gathering data on this whole issue of racial and minority disparities, is there, not only do you share data, is there conversation around the whole issue of developing strategies so that this information is in the hands of the right providers in such a way that we can measure the success? When public health was in here a week or so ago, there was no performance measure around this in public health. And I have to tell you, this chair is disturbed by that. And if you guys are collecting data, it would appear to me that the integrity of what you do is more enhanced when you can say this is the problem and this is our strategy for getting to the problem. Then I'm going to start believing the integrity of the information you give, because I should tell you, you're the only one that have been this forthcoming in terms of this issue, so I want to thank you for that and see how you can provide leadership for us to come to some kind of strategy, you know, strategizing where we can deal with the issue. And some people might think this is just a social issue, but let me tell you what makes sense to me. If we're spending $800 million, and you know that's a very low number, just a number off the top of my head, we're spending, Jim, $800 some odd on health care in this country, in this state in particular, and we've got to urge and push and promote people to look at the racial disparities in this, we're not doing anything about bringing down the cost of health care, let's face it. And so thank you so much for what you've done, and now I'm going to ask you to be a leader in asking these people to come together. Why in the heck would somebody come before this department and this committee and see three African-American women sitting up here, and you're not going to have anything around the issue of performance measure? That's absolute stupid in this state that we call Oregon. And for something like this to happen, so, Jim, I'm complimenting you guys. I hope you don't think it sounds like I'm on you, but I need some leadership here. It makes common sense. It saves the state money.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for those comments. I would say the department already, even before I have gotten here, they are already active in sharing this information. There has been discussion on racial and ethnic disparities. As I look back over minutes and agendas of prior meetings, the contractors are actively involved in this issue, and that is our intent to continue forward this discussion with them, sharing the information, sharing this latest report, talking about strategies that they can employ. And I have in my notes that there are other strategies that other managed care organizations have employed, such as information on diabetes and tobacco cessation was provided at the African American Wellness Village event. Another managed care company translated all of their plans, phone greetings, into Spanish, Vietnamese, and Russian. So I think, Madam Chair and members of the committee, there is really a commitment on the part of both the department and the managed care organizations to not just to look at this data, but really to develop some strategies and interventions to reduce the disparities. And we're excited to be a part of that discussion and a part of that strategy.
And I know you're new, and I really appreciate what you've done so far. It tells us that there's a new leader on the horizon along the lines of this issue. And for any of Dr. Goldberg's people that are listening to me, I don't want not one other agency to come before this committee and insult my intelligence and my integrity about not talking about diversity and issues surrounding racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare. Not one other one.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what I would sum up on my portion would be just to say that for our part, we are going to continue to share best practices and strategies for increasing cultural competence of providers and in terms of all of the providers, and reducing those racial and ethnic disparities. At this time, it's my honor to turn over to Dr. Schaefer, who will take the presentation for the next section.
And again, I want to thank you for your leadership.
Thank you.
Representative Kota?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank you for handing out this report. I think the analysis of the collaborative around diabetes care for Hispanics and health plan with managed care is really interesting. Do you plan on asking the contractors to adopt what looks like successful methods out of the family care model to work with this population on diabetes?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, yes, well, what we would do, we would share the report with them, ask them to look at those strategies and interventions in terms of what makes sense for their population. I think one of the key values is the methodology, that they're doing the self-assessment, they're looking at their population, they're looking at what are the barriers to care, and then they're designing their interventions in terms of what makes sense for them. And these are excellent, excellent ideas, so we will be sharing those.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I have a follow-up question? Thank you. Are you also, in talking to your managed care organization of providers, looking at perhaps, you know, we require that you have performance standards, and we require that you come back and determine whether or not you're reaching the goals that you have set. Inside of your contracts, are you setting goals for them, particularly when we look at strategies for reducing among
the various racial and ethnic groups of saying, will you have reduced X by X? Because I think it's one thing to have the standard kind of contract. It's another thing to, with inside of those contracts, our expectation. We're expecting, when you come back before us, certain things to have happened. And so are you going to have the same expectation through the contract process with your managed care organizations?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, that is how we would approach that. There is existing contract with the managed care companies, organizations. They're reviewed, and they are updated, and that would be our intent to include that. They do now have requirements for performance improvement projects within the contract now, and each year we review those in terms of how we want to update those contracts.
So I can expect follow-up. I can expect that when you come back before this body and the question is asked and raised with respect to the racial and ethnic disparities issue, that you can tell me that they are inside of those contracts and there is the expectation that their strategies will be there to address some of these disparities.
Madam Chair, Senator Winter, that yes, that would be the intent, to update those contracts with those elements.
The leadership's refreshing.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Porter.
Refreshing, underlined, exclamation point. I see within what you've just agreed to that there's another opportunity to work collaboratively with the Office of Multicultural Health as you're looking at those contracts. Do you see the same opportunity?
Madam Chair, Senator Gorley, yes. I would see that as an opportunity. This is a topic that calls out for collaboration and working with multiple stakeholders.
And then just a follow-up and last question. Is there a table within your department around which there is a regular meeting that includes public health, including Office of Multicultural Health, a table within the Department of Human Services around which you all talk regularly about these issues, talk specifically about the racial and ethnic health disparities as a public policy issue and how we're going to move the state forward? Does that table exist?
Madam Chair, Senator Gorley, I'm not aware if that forum exists. I think it would be an excellent idea, but I'm not aware if there's a forum such as that.
Madam Chair, Senator Gorley, those issues are discussed in Dr. Goldberg's cabinet meetings, not on a regular basis, not every meeting, and I certainly take to heart your suggestion that we do it on a more regular basis and make sure that Mr. Mason's office is involved in that also.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate your comments very much, Madam Chair.
Gentlemen, I hope you don't mind. John, I'd like you to prepare a letter and have a letter to go to Dr. Goldberg asking that there be a strong collaboration on the issue of racial and ethnic health, and that this collaboration would report back to, and I'll talk with the co-chairs about reporting back to the E-board the status of shared constituency.
Madam Chair, if you wish, you can include that as a budget note within the budget report.
That. How does the committee feel about that? I know how you guys feel. I feel my other committee.
An excellent idea, Madam Chair.
How do you feel about that, Representative Garrard?
I would support the chair.
Thank you. And you, Senator Morissette. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Madam Chair, this is such a high cost issue.
That's right.
It is an extremely high cost issue when we talk about diabetes and early child premature births and some of these issues that are there, the cost to the body. I you raise that, and I want to put it back on record because I think some might think that it's just an issue that because we are African Americans, but the fact is everybody should be concerned about this. it's costing not only in human capital, but it's costing in economic capital. And so it's one of those drivers that we have to begin to do something about it. When you look at these figures that are in this document alone, and some of us serve on the national groups and trying to make certain that all racial groups are having medical care to address these issues, and the prevention that was mentioned earlier plays right into that, because when you know how to have good nutrition, you may not end up with having diabetes or some of those other issues. So it really is an economic, it's very costly. And maybe John can get us some of the national figures for some of the members of this panel, because once you see the cost, it's astronomical when you start beginning to tease out these numbers. And I want to thank you.
Thank you, Senator Winters.
Thank you.
Chair Carter, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Walter Schaefer. I'm the Medical Director of Division of Medical Assistance Programs, and we will continue perhaps in a somewhat briefer fashion to go through the remainder of the performance measures the Oregon Health Plan uses to monitor its population. So there are a couple of measures that relate to access to early prenatal care, starting with Key Performance Measure 17 on page 41. The initiation of prenatal care early in pregnancy is important for management of just about every aspect of pregnancy. It's important to establish the dating of the pregnancy, the due date, and monitor the growth of the baby. It's important for managing medical problems like diabetes, and it's really important to have early intervention for lifestyle choices that pregnant women make, including particularly things like cigarette smoking, alcohol intake, drug use. So it's an important factor, and these two measures look at how well we do at getting pregnant women in early in the pregnancy. The first one is developed jointly with the Public Health Division, and it looks at low-income women, so it's both Medicaid and non-Medicaid covered pregnancies, measures the rate of prenatal visits within the first 4 months of the pregnancy. And the graph on page 42 shows that this has been relatively stable over the last few years, in the mid-85% range. And actually there was some problem with the printing of the statistics, so there actually is a number for 2004. First of all, the years are the zero is year 2000, the one is 2001. And so for 2004, the figure for this is 85.7%, so relatively stable. And not really too bad from looking at this criteria, but the problem with this measure is there are several problems with the methodology. It's based on a survey, so it's based on recall of the woman as far as when the pregnancy care was initiated. The definition of low income kind of changes from year to year as described in the report. Because several states use this survey, but the results have to be validated by the organization. It takes a long time for Oregon and to get the results back. So really the most recent results we have are from 2004. Some targets have been selected for this measure, but it's a little hard to tell if we're actually meeting the targets in 2007, since we only have results from up to 2004. So we've developed another outcome measure, which is on page 43, and this one
rather than a survey, it uses our own Oregon Health Plan data as far as which pregnancies are covered by on OHP, and the information from when concerning when the prenatal care was initiated is obtained from birth certificates, which should be relatively accurate for this measure. The numbers are lower on this measure because it's just the first trimester, which by is the first third of pregnancy, so by definition it's the first 13 weeks. So it's a little shorter period, but actually the important period to start prenatal care. And the results show basic stability. The kind of cream-colored off-white bar is Oregon average, a little above 80% of pregnant women are seen in the first trimester. Uninsured is the red bar, it's down around 60%. And then the Oregon Health Plan line, the blue line, it kind of splits the difference, just shy of 70%. So clearly on the Oregon Health Plan we're not doing as well as the average, and I think part of the dynamic has to do with a gap that pregnant women have to cross from being uninsured to qualifying and then becoming insured on the Oregon Health Plan. They may not be able to bridge that gap during the first trimester. It may take too long. So a lot of our department's interventions are related to trying to shorten the time that it takes women to get onto the Oregon Health Plan when they are pregnant, and the project is called Oregon Mother's Care. It's coordinated by the Public Health Division, Office of Family Health, and Division of Medical Assistance Programs works with this project. There are a number of access sites around the state where, for example, in county health departments, safety net clinics, rural health clinics, hospitals, where once a woman has proof of pregnancy from the doctor, then the process to get enrolled is expedited through these access sites. The goal is within 24 hours, and if not within 24 hours, at least within 1 to 5 days of the world to get enrolled in the health plan. And then once a woman is enrolled and assigned to a managed care organization, then part of the division's process is to notify the managed care organization and expedite the first prenatal appointment. So that's what we're doing, and I assume the results would be not as good if those efforts weren't being done.
Madam Chair. Thank you. Thank you for going into this particular topic. I noticed on page 44 you make reference to presumptive eligibility.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that Will 1 and State 2 does not do that.
Yes.
And although I think going in mother's care does great work, they're woefully underfunded. Have you costed what it would take us to go to presumptive eligibility so we're not having that gap? And could you get us those numbers? Because, you know, California's at 82%. They have presumptive eligibility. I would argue that plays a big role.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have to wait.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I don't know in the past if we have costed out this option, but I would think that we could come up with some numbers currently. As Representative Kotek has pointed out on the Western States Comparison Table on page 45, California is up at 82% of women who are seen during the first trimester, and 31 states have this presumptive eligibility, so that while the application process is going on, services can be provided and covered by the Medicaid agency in California and those other states. I suppose the argument against it is that services then get provided to women who turn out to not be eligible, but you know, clearly if this is important, it may be worth that cost.
So what is the difference? And I understand you're talking about the cost, but how is it? Is it the cost factor that allows them to have better data in terms of who they serve and that are Medicaid eligible than what we do? Tell me the difference.
Madam Chair, I mean, the difference in the system is once in California and the other states that have presumptive eligibility, once the woman has proof of pregnancy, she then has her prenatal visits paid for while the eligibility process is completed. So the eligibility is presumed. Mm-hmm. And in Oregon and other states, you have to complete the eligibility process before services are covered.
And so what kind of time period does it vary? What kind of time period are we talking about?
Well,
how long would it take us as a state to determine eligibility?
Well, Madam Chair, we have an expedited process, so the goal is to have the enrollment completed within 5 days. As far as how we're actually doing, I'm not sure, and we could, I would suppose, track that information and come up with some figures, but it's one of the factors that takes time that prevents women from getting in early.
So it's upfront costs that we're talking about as the difference in terms of why California's ability to be at 82% for those women in receiving prenatal care, and Oregon and Washington is at 69.2. Is that 5-day difference the real big difference between the data points?
Madam Chair, well, first of all, it may be, 5 days is the goal, but it may be longer than that.
Yeah.
I think partly it's on the part of the individual. There's perceptions, and if the perception is that they don't have insurance and they aren't covered, then it may take women longer to go through the process. Whereas in states that perhaps have this presumptive eligibility, women may know that once they're pregnant, they can get covered. So partly it's a matter of how the individual.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I might add that if there is a piece of documentation missing from an application, that application is then pended. And that's probably the bigger disparity, is if an application is pended for additional information, it might take a month to 45 days to get the information from the client and determine eligibility and get the person on the Oregon Health Plan. We're in a state with presumptive eligibility, and they would be receiving services during that entire time. And as Dr. Schaefer mentions, there's some possibility that some of those individuals may turn out not to be eligible, and that's maybe the reason that some states have not implemented presumptive eligibility. But those states that have feel it's important enough to get those women into health care, into prenatal care, despite the fact that their application isn't complete.
Senator, what is in awareness?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In Oregon, what is the criteria for the expedited 5-day process?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, the criteria for the expedited process is just proof of pregnancy, which comes from the physician or from the health department where there's a positive pregnancy test. So that's all that's needed. And then, of course, the income requirements have to be met. And in Oregon, it's up to 185% of the federal poverty level for pregnancy coverage.
Okay, I'm missing something. How do women know that this expedited process is available to them?
They don't necessarily. So that's what the purpose, one of the goals of the Oregon Mother's Care Project is, to have, they have something like 260 access sites around the state to educate women and market the fact that these services are available and covered under the Oregon Health Plan if you're pregnant.
Senator
Marsat. I have just a quick question. Do you have, or can you get for us, what the low birth rates are for California and what ours is? Because that has a direct implication of prenatal care.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, I would assume that the Public Health Division biostatistics section has the statistics on low birth weight for Oregon and for California. So I don't think there'd be any problem providing you with those numbers. We wouldn't. I don't think we have them in the Division of Medical Assistance Programs, but
it would be helpful to add that information to the California, Nevada, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, since we're looking at budgetary issues and California is at 82% for the first trimester, and we're at 69%. And can we validate that because they're at 82, we're having an impact? They're having an impact on healthier babies, and because that's at the crux of the discussion. So it would be very helpful, I think, if we had that kind of information in comparison to validate or justify what California is doing versus what we're not doing.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Marcel?
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think the crux of the discussion is fiscal impact. How many people are out there that would this kind of eligibility would be included? How many extra people would we include if we did what California is doing? Any idea?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, Judith Peterson from our caseload unit will be here during the presentation tomorrow, I think it is, and she would be the person to answer that question, and we'll make sure that she answers that.
Just to follow up, please.
Yes, sir, maybe.
I think that any given woman who came and was denied the eligibility over some technicalities would be a woman who would benefit and the child would benefit. I think it would be a benefit in general if we did have this type of eligibility. But I know the resources are scarce and we have to weigh that with other programs, but it would be interesting to know how many people would be involved and how much it might cost.
Madam Chair, should we try to continue with a couple more?
What can you do for us in 3 minutes?
Well, we can get through the measure on immunizations.
All right.
That's on page 45.
Okay.
And that page lists a required slew of immunizations that are required not all at once, but over various age ranges, so that by the age of 2 years, this set of immunizations is required, and the table on page 46 shows how we're doing. The national average is in blue, just above 70%, up to almost 78% in 2005. Oregon average is a little bit lower than that in red, and actually dropped down this last from between 2004 and 2005 to 68.7%, and then the Oregon Health Plan rates in the off-white color are lower, averaging around 60% currently. These are not as good as they should be. The report does go over some of the interventions that Oregon is utilizing. The alert registry is really an excellent tool that we have, where any immunization that's given at a private or public facility is recorded in the same database, so that then when the child comes in to either a private clinic or a public clinic, all the pool of information is available, so that information really works pretty well.
I'm sorry for interrupting. Will the Healthy Kids Plan, do you think we will see an increase in this number? 63 is kind of low. Here we are way down the ladder, actually. So mm-hmm. Would the Healthy Kids proposal, or with the school-based clinics having more resources, shouldn't we see this number increase?
Madam Chair, with the Healthy Kids Plan, I would say we would be assured that the numbers would be improved, because this type of preventive service is covered on the Oregon Health Plan, and so to have continuity of care for kids, and because one of the reasons the the rates are lower is that they may be covered for a while by the Oregon Health Plan, get some of the shots, and then lose eligibility and not have insurance anymore. And so with the Healthy Kids Plan, we should have better continuity and a more seamless system to keep kids covered. As far as the school-based programs, of course, most of these immunizations are required prior to school entry, and so most of them are in the younger years, but even so, some of them are required later, and those would be improved with the school-based health clinics.
Thank you.
So,
any thoughts or idea of why there is a decline?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, I don't have a specific, theory on why the Oregon rates have declined, and I'm not sure that it's significant, but comparing like the Oregon Health Plan rates dropping from 63 to 59, neither one of them is very good, so it is going in the wrong direction. But there are other interventions that can help. I think part of the problem is parents aren't aware and kind of lost track of the importance of these immunizations, because most of these diseases they haven't seen, polio and measles, and so there's a continued education process that we need to do.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think I'm the only one who's not happy with that answer. I look at the routine numbers that you have early on about kids are getting routine care.
Mm-hmm.
This is a pretty basic routine care issue. The cycling on and off, I think that's something to look into, and I think with healthy kids, when the 12-month continuous, the 12-month eligibility, we won't see the cycling. This is, if these kids are on the plan, they're coming in, they should be immunized. So can we get some better answers, maybe? Talk to the immunization program, because I need a little more information than what you just gave us.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I completely agree. At least the immunization rates are not acceptable, not only in the Oregon Health Plan, but even the better states' Medicaid agencies on the table. On page 47, Maryland gets 74%, but even that's not very good, and even the national average isn't very good. So, part of the problem is we are working in a healthcare system that does not emphasize success in this what appears to be a very basic, important public health measure. Our providers are not rewarded for keeping track of immunizations. They're more rewarded for MRI scans and heart surgeries. So I think it's partly the system that we have now that we're trying to improve doesn't emphasize this type of preventive care. Short of that, within the system, we can work with the managed care organizations and with our providers, and we actually are doing quite a bit of that. It turns out one of the techniques that increases the immunization rate that's just been kind of become more obvious in the last couple of years is that if you give the immunizations at the earliest possible time in the range for that immunization, you end up with better results later. A lot of physicians have been waiting to a later time, but what we've done is education sessions with the quality improvement coordinators of the plans and the medical directors to educate them about these techniques for increasing the immunization rates. So hopefully we'll see some improvement. But those, I think, are they're important, but they'll be relatively minor changes until we have a system that emphasizes these preventive measures in a better fashion.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to follow up on the good representative, because part of our responsibility, whether it's through public health or other avenues, is to educate. I can turn on the boob tube and see all kinds of medical education, everything from before I went into hospital for PAD and what have you, educating the public as to the medical universe. And I think, you know, to scratch our heads, I guess I'm just as frustrated when you're talking about immunization and we need to find a way, if the public isn't educated, if parents aren't educated, to educate them, you know, to the necessity of it. Though most, you know, like myself, when we were young, it was just kind of automatic. You know, I think all of us probably still had the scar on our shoulders from when we received immunization. And it was done as a preventive measure. So
I understand how much work we got to do, doesn't it?
Well, it says not only how much work we've got to do, but we need to be mindful that we don't live in a cocoon, and so we need to educate through all the avenues that we have at our disposal. And so if public health is listening, they do have a responsibility to educate. To educate, whether it's through the doctor's office, whether it's through the TV meeting, whatever that's out there, and through the various clinics. And I don't want to be in mid-range, and I don't care if, and I'd like to exceed Maryland.
I am so glad to hear you say that, Senator, because that means that all of you guys are going to be supporting me as I fight for the public health budget. Because we do
well, as long as they decide to go forward with some strategies. I'm not supporting a budget, and then they don't follow through.
But they only get federal dollars. They don't get anything from
I know.
State. Yeah, so we got to work hard on that end, too.
Absolutely.
Chairman, thank you. Thanks for a great presentation.
Yeah,
thank
you.
Thank you.
Thanks for entertaining all our questions.
No, I'm still saying.